Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the LSE. Thanks very much for coming. And welcome to this panel discussion co-sponsored by the Forum for European Philosophy and the Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Science on hive minds, collective intelligence in humans and other animals. The key questions we'll be discussing in this event are the following. First of all, is there collective intelligence in social insects, such as bees? If so, what is the evidence for it? What kind of form does it take? Secondly, do we also find forms of collective intelligence in humans? And if we do, are collectives of humans smarter or stupider than swarms of bees? And thirdly, what can humans learn from bees? What practical advice can we take from these social insects about the best ways to act together and make collective decisions? And I'm really pleased to be able to introduce three panellists who, in different ways, are brilliantly qualified to discuss these issues. First of all, Ellie Leadbetter, reader in biology, Royal Holloway, University of London, and an expert in social insect biology. Larissa Conrad from the Centre for Adaptive Rationality at the Max Planck Institute for Human Development. And Christian List, Professor of Philosophy and Political Science here at the LSE. Now, I'll just briefly explain the format for this event. We've got an hour and a half, three key questions. What I'll do is I'll invite for each question one of the panellists to introduce that question with a few brief introductory remarks. Then we'll have a discussion among the panel about that topic. And then I'll throw it open to questions and contributions from the audience on that particular topic. And then we'll move on to the next one. And then we'll cover all three topics. So the first key question, as I said, what is the evidence for collective intelligence in bees and in other social insects? And to introduce us to that question, I'll hand over to Ellie.
Thank you. Okay, to stand up with the mic. Yep. Okay, so hello everybody. I want you to picture a honeybee swarm. So it is late spring. Hopefully everything's gone well for this colony. So there were a lot of flowers, a lot of nectar and pollen, and the colony collected a lot of food, which means that it grew. So now there are an awful lot of worker bees crammed into a small space like a tree cavity. And hopefully they've also done so well that they've produced a new queen, which is great, right? Because that's what honeybee colonies are all about. A new queen means genes into the next generation. This is exactly what should happen. But it also creates a problem, because you can't have two queens in one honeybee colony. So that means that one of these queens is going to have to leave with half of the workers and find a new home. And that home is going to have to be somewhere quite special. So it's going to have to be somewhere that the bees can heat over the winter, because they need to maintain a temperature of about 26 degrees for the colony to survive. So it's going to have to be not too big, because that would be drafty, but not too small, because they need to store a lot of honey. So that's the stage that this swarm is at. This is a swarm of bees who've left their colony and they're camped out on a tree nearby, and they've got about 3 days to make a decision about where they're going to go. So because they've got such specific requirements, you might think it would be hard to find a suitable tree cavity or chimney or wherever they're going to go. But actually, that's not so much of a problem. So quite a high proportion of this group are going to be scout bees, so their job is to go out individually and look for these cavities. So they'll diligently visit all the trees in the local area, all the houses, all the eaves under the roofs of the houses, to find a cavity that might work. And between them, they can cover about a 3-mile radius. So collecting the information is not so hard when you're in a big group. But the problem is, no bee can visit all of the particular areas. So at most, they're probably going to find one or two potential sites. So how do they then bring all that information together? Because at the end of the 3 days, they're going to have to set off as a swarm, cohesively, with their queen, and fly straight to this site. How do they decide which of all these many sites that have been found is the best one? And it's really important that they do decide together, because if the swarm splits, then that's an evolutionary dead end. A swarm needs a queen to survive. If it splits, then they'll lose her somewhere. So, to explain how they do it, it's important that you know that honeybees have a communication system whereby they can tell each other, or go back to the swarm and communicate, recruit other bees to particular sites that are far away from the swarm. And that mechanism, that system, is famously known as the waggle dance. So what the waggle dance is a figure of eight dance, which is carried out on the surface of the swarm, or inside the hive in other contexts, and the bee just runs around like this over and over again. The length of this run indicates the distance that other bees should fly to get to this site, and the direction, the angle to the vertical indicates the angle that the other bees should fly relative to the sun. So in effect, they're giving each other coordinates of where to go. But that's great, they can communicate about where to go, but then how do they make this decision? Well, actually, first let me show you a picture of bees doing this communication. So this is inside a hive. You see these red arrows come up whenever a bee is doing a dance. There's one here. There's another one dancing along here. You see she's going backwards and forwards. They're all indicating a direction over here, so about 270 degrees to the sun. So they have this beautiful... shouldn't turn the sound off. They have this beautiful communication system, but how do they reach this consensus? And they do it by following a very simple rule. So imagine you're a scout bee, you're at the swarm, and then you find a site somewhere distant from the swarm, which you think is an okay site. It's an average, it'll do. So you go back to the swarm and you dance, but you only dance a bit, so you might attract one or two, you might recruit one or two other bees to that site. So they'll go out, check out that site, come back, and they'll also dance a little bit, so they might recruit a few more bees. You can see that slowly there'll be a feedback system whereby the number of bees going to that site will build up, but it's slow. So compare that to a site which another scout finds, which might be really, really good. So she finds this great sucker site, and she goes back to the swarm, and she dances for a long time. So lots of other bees that are milling around the swarm, lots of other scouts, are likely to bump into her dancing and extract the information from the dance and go to that site. So they go back to that site, let's say 10 bees go there, they check it out, they also decide that it's a good site, and they go back to the swarm and dance. So they also, say, each recruit 10 bees from that dance. You can see that there'll be a groundswell of opinion towards that particular site, towards the good site, which quickly overtakes any support for the poor site, or the average site. So eventually, all the dancers on the swarm, or nearly all the dancers, are likely to converge on a particular site, which is great. They seem to have made a decision, but then how do they actually know they've made a decision? Individual bees can't really go around the swarm counting how many dancers there are for a particular site. That would be a pretty hard task to do. So there's a simple mechanism, which means they know when they've reached a consensus, which is that the bees that are following the dances and flying out to the particular site, every time they go, they take note of how many other bees they bump into when they're there. So if they bump into what they consider to be a large density of bees, that must mean there's a lot of dances for this particular site that are sending the other bees to this site. So at that point, if there's enough bees there, their behaviour changes. When they go back to the swarm, they don't dance anymore. They, in fact, signal to the other bees to stop dancing, and they start to warm up the swarm. So they start to vibrate the wing muscles of the other bees, which is a signal that the swarm is about to move. And then within half an hour or so, they'll take off together as a cohesive unit and fly directly to that new nest site, which might look something like this. So this would be a classic natural modern nest site for a bee colony, a swarming bee colony, to choose. So in the eaves of somebody's house. So the bees almost always make the right decision. So in experiments where people put out different nest boxes and let the bees choose between them, they almost always choose the one which is optimal for them. But they're not doing it through any form of subjective decision-making. They're doing it because evolution has shaped their decision-making process using these really simple rules of just dance more from the great site. And in order to produce a self-organised process which leads to a really good decision. And so that's all I was going to say about
these
swarms.
Thanks very much, Ellie. I'd now like to invite the other panellists to respond. Let's start with Larissa.
Okay, so you have mentioned that people have done experiments with giving them different nest sites. So how did the people know what is actually in the interest of the bee? Mm-hmm. And what the bee measures in these nest sites for the individual bees? Yeah. How they decide what is best for them? Is
it there's kind of two questions there. The first one is, how do people know what the bees want? Mm-hmm. And the second one is, how do the bees decide which is a good site? So the way people know what the bees want was by actually going around and cutting down a huge number of trees around Cornell, which is where this research was done, and looking at which cavities feral bees had chosen to nest in. So this was done by Professor Tom Seeley, and he spent a lot of time chopping down these trees and looking at the cavities that they'd chosen. So he later did experiments where he put out different nest boxes and he forced the bees to pick particular ones, and he found that the ones that they, if they picked ones which were similar to these natural nest cavities in terms of size, in terms of where the entrance is, because you want a low entrance so the heat doesn't escape, then the colonies did much better at surviving the winter. Mm-hmm. The bees themselves, they actually take into account, I think it's 6 different variables when they're choosing the nest site. So one of them is size, which I talked about a lot, and the nest entrance. So you don't want it to be really high because the heat's all going to escape, and that heat is really precious if you're an overwintering bee colony. You also don't want the nest itself to be very low because, A, you're exposed to humans who typically don't like bees, get rid of bees' nests, but you're also exposed to ground-based predators. And a bee colony is a really valuable resource for a lot of mammals because it's got this huge energy collection in the honeycomb.
Yeah, I think the most striking feature of this process is how democratic it actually is. I mean, conventionally, people sometimes think that democracy is very much a human invention or a human idea, and we associate forms of hierarchical decision-making with animals. And of course, as we are increasingly learning in recent work in biology, that is just not at all the case, and there are many instances of seemingly democratic decision processes in animals, and here we really have a completely egalitarian process to which hundreds of scout bees contribute by feeding in the dispersed information that they collect, and the overall decision is not at all made by any particular lead animal, but it is really made through this collective information pooling and decision process. And I mean, the particularly striking thing is that here we have a form of democratic decision making, even among social insects that are individually much simpler systems or creatures than mammals, for instance, let alone humans.
Mm-hmm. I think it always seems really impressive to me how democratic it is. But actually, when I was thinking about this particular event, I was thinking, well, it's kind of a limited democracy because even though each individual scout's opinion is treated equally. The scouts are only a very small proportion of the actual colony. So in a way, so all the other bees just sit there on the tree, not really doing very much, waiting for the decision to be made for them. Now, the scout bees are actually the oldest bees in the colony. They're the ones with a lot of experience of the surrounding area, so it makes sense that they're the ones who go out and look for the nest sites. But in a way, it seems to me it's a little bit like having a body of experts, in a way. And it's a large body of experts, but it's not the case that everybody gets an equal say.
Just one more comment on this. So in that sense, it's of course a form of democracy that is a bit more like what is sometimes called an epistocracy, a rule by expertise, although the body of experts here still forms a democratic committee. But perhaps the way in which this can be explained or even justified in this particular case is that the only point of democratic voting among the bees is really to achieve a maximally reliable outcome for the group as a whole in order to find a safe and decent new home. The act of voting here has no particular intrinsic or procedural significance for them. It's purely instrumental. And in the human case, we vote not only for instrumental reasons. I mean, we also want a good outcome for all of us. But in addition, it has a much more intrinsic or procedural and even symbolic significance for every single one of us. And that's, of course, why we would not want to introduce this form of, I don't know, pure epistocratic democracy in the human case.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think a big difference, or a reason why this is relatively easy to produce in a bee system, is because every individual in this colony has the same priorities, in a way, because they only reproduce through the queen surviving and getting genes into the next generation. They have a very shared interest in promoting the survival of the queen, who needs the colony. So they don't necessarily have different priorities or different opinions about what would be best. Evolution has shaped what is best, and it shaped their system towards producing a decision that can identify the best nest site, in a way. So maybe this consensus decision making is nice, but it can, I don't know how easy it would be to achieve in a system where people have different priorities.
I think part of what fascinates me about this is that on the one hand you've got these very suggestive analogies to a democracy. On the other hand, also I think really striking analogies to the workings of a brain or a mind. In that, you know, the scout bees are like the perception system, right? They're bringing in information from the environment. Then you have this sort of feedback process that is a bit cognition-like, in which the nest sites that have the best properties gradually accrue more and more representation. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this critical threshold that's crossed. And suddenly when you cross that threshold, it triggers a decision, an action, in the way that, you know, sort of critical masses of neurons firing can trigger a decision in a brain. So is this really just a superficial analogy, or do you think there's a sense in which there's literally a hive mind making a decision?
There are definitely similarities. So evolution seems to have produced the same systems over and over again in some ways. So I suppose the analogy would be that each bee is a very simple unit. I would argue they're quite intelligent as well, but they make simple decisions. They can only find one cavity, for example. And each neuron in a brain is also a simple unit. So all that it really does is fire or not fire. So in a way, the brain is a collection of neurons that are all firing, making these simple decisions on their own. But then when they're integrated together, a more complex property emerges, the same way as it does for a swarm. And there are definitely, so some of the details of the swarm that I didn't go into. There are, when the bees discover a good site, they'll also, in addition to doing a really long, really intense dance for it, they'll also target other bees who are dancing for different sites and signal to them to stop dancing. So they kind of inhibit the dances of other bees. And that's something that we also see with neurons. So this kind of inhibition of neurons that are firing for a different stimulus in the brain is kind of similar to bees that are firing or dancing for a different site. So there's definitely similarities. I'm not quite sure how far they really go.
Okay, I'd now like to invite some questions from the audience on this particular topic. Ideally, it'd be great if we could have a batch of three questions to then put to the panel. So put your hands up if you have a question, and please keep them as short and on topic as possible so that we can get in more later on. Let's start over here.
Thank you. Could one equate the recent referendum in the UK to bee dance with the media, you know, being the little dances, and then, you know, each trying to take over from the other?
Thanks. Great question. Let's do three at once. So the next one from the middle of the third row here, and then we'll go to the back at the far side.
Thank you. I wanted to ask whether you think, well, what makes a social animal social as opposed to non-social, solitary? And do you expect or do you not expect that there will be some genetic commonality between bees, humans, dolphins, anything that are strongly social? Do you expect there to be any genetic basis or not?
Thanks very much. And the third question from the very far end of the second row from back. And please do wait for the microphone to come to you so that we can get the question on the podcast, even though it may require a bit of patience.
Hello. I'd like to preface this. I'm a beekeeper, and I completely agree with you on the right that I believe they do act as a hive mind because we're all going for this one greater good, that everything is sort of altruistic for the colony, but it's not altruistic because you're sharing your genes with a queen and so on. But my question is that I've seen some beehives in quite bad locations that have got cold in winter and died or gone into a rotten tree stump on the ground level and been eaten by mice and stuff. You say in your study that almost all pick the best site. Why do the bees not always pick the best site? Is this a lack of communication? Is it a misjudgment of what a good nest site is? And so on, basically.
Thanks very much. So three fantastic questions. Relationships to Brexit. What is it that makes a species social rather than solitary, and is there a genetic basis for that is shared across different species? And what happens when things go wrong? Can this hive mind make a misjudgment, and if so, why? Let's start with Ellie.
Okay. So let's start with the question about Brexit. So this is something that I've kind of been thinking about quite a lot recently, that the main difference I can see between this system, and I'm sure Christian's got something to add on this, is that an integral part of what the bees do is fact-checking. So there's no cases where the bee to the hive dances and other bees start to dance for that site. They always go to that site. So if somebody makes a bad misjudgment, it's not repeated, it's checked by the bees. So there's kind of this fact-checking mechanism which prevents a kind of informational cascade, which to me seems like a sensible thing. A question about social animals. So insect biologists have a slightly different definition of what makes you social to vertebrate biologists. So our definition would be, we call these social insects, but what we really mean is eusocial. And eusocial is a eusocial insect is a situation where individuals have given up reproduction for themselves. So you have castes who can't reproduce, and their whole role is cooperation, so helping the queen. So that's what we consider to be a social insect. In mammals, for example, the definition would be different. So we only have one eusocial mammal, I think. One case where, so that's the naked mole rat, where individuals actually can't reproduce for themselves. They behave like workers, and all they do is help their queen reproduce. But we do see some commonalities, not You mean at the genetic level, is that right? So there are things like, so there's one particular neuropeptide, so like a neural hormone, which seems to control, so in humans, it's very important in social behavior. So this is oxytocin. If you give people nasal sprays of oxytocin, they trust each other more, that kind of thing. But the analog of this in mammals is something which is very heavily involved in social behavior as well. So it determines things like whether the mating system is monogamous or polygamous, that kind of thing. So there are some commonalities, yes. And the third question was about beekeeping and why bees make bad decisions. And the answer is, we don't know. But the thing that occurs to me is that there's always, or almost always, more than one swarm from a good colony, right? So what happens is the colony sends out a swarm, and then if there are enough bees left in the colony, they'll send out a secondary swarm. So it could be that the secondary swarm, the good nest sites get chosen by the first swarm, and the secondary swarms end up choosing the less optimal ones. It could also be that there are no good local nest sites and they pick the best of the ones that were available to them.
So. Was that found in your study about cast swarms or secondary swarms? Or was it the study was on primary swarms?
That was on primary swarms. Well, those were on swarms that were artificially created. So it's not my study. But this was on an island where there are no natural nest sites at all. And so what they do is create swarms and then give them different potential nest sites and then see which one they chose. And in that particular study, 90% of them chose the nest site which matched what their natural nest sites would look like.
Yeah, so maybe one quick comment on the Brexit question. I mean, there are multiple disanalogies between the Brexit issue and the bees' nest site choice. I mean, one is that the mechanism is obviously very different, and as already emphasized, that the fact-checking really is a key element of the bees' decision process. But also the nature of the question that was being asked in the referendum is very, very different from the bees'. Decision. In the bees' case, we assume that there is a shared criterion or standard of what would constitute a good decision, because there is a kind of objective quality standard for nest sites, and then the bees try to pick the best nest site they can with respect to this objective standard of a good quality nest site. But in the Brexit case, there was much less agreement even on what the appropriate criterion should be for figuring out the right answer to this question. I mean, maybe if you settle on one criterion, just something like economic growth or the exchange rate of the pound, then it's pretty obvious what the right answer would be. If you focus on some completely different criterion, then there might be potentially a different right answer. And quite apart from the fact that there was a lot of empirical uncertainty about all the different factual underpinnings of the decision, there was also no consensus whatsoever on which evaluative criterion to use to assess the outcomes. And so that's really a big difference from the bees' decision problem.
The bees ask themselves a really precise question, don't they? I mean, they get as much information as they can about the options and then look for the best option rather than saying, you know, should we go vaguely over there or vaguely over there?
Yeah.
That too is an important aspect of why they're so successful, do you think?
Yes, certainly. I mean, you mean the fact that they can... that they can find all these, they have all the information available to them because they have all these scouts. Right?
But part of the process is finding as many potential nest sites as possible, yeah, rather than having a simple binary choice.
Yeah, and that's a very distinct part of the process. So that's what it all begins with. That's why it takes so long.
The analogy would be a kind of referendum between well-specified options of, you know, hard Brexit, soft Brexit,
yeah,
remaining under these terms, remaining under these terms, which is, of course, exactly what we didn't have. Larissa?
Yeah, okay.
Yes, I'll just explain the question again that Larissa is going to introduce for us. We're switching over to humans now. I mean, we'll talk more later about how we can make things better with our own decision-making. But we're going to talk now about, do humans also display collective intelligence? If so, in what kind of ways, in what kind of context do we display it? And on the whole, are human collectives smarter or stupider than swarms of bees? Mm-hmm. There is.
Okay, I want to first of all stay briefly with the animals before I go over to humans. I mean, one of the things which here in these bees is really important, why they are collectively so intelligent, is that the information is distributed between individuals. So no one single bee holds all the information, has seen all the nest sites. So no one single bee can actually make this decision on its own. All the relevant information is distributed between the scouts. So collective intelligence is particularly beneficial or profitable if a lot of individuals hold different information which can be then pooled to achieve the best decision. Yeah? And this is the case in these scout bees because they seek, individuals seek information, and different individuals go to different places and have different and hold different information, and then they integrate that. Yeah? But this is a system with very diffuse information or distributed information between individuals. But of course not all collective decisions are like that. And very often in animals which are not eusocial, you have got, especially in long-lived animal species, the older animals in the group might have more information than younger, unexperienced individuals. And then it makes actually more sense for a group that the older, knowledgeable, and informed individuals make a decision between them, rather than making a distributed decision or a majority decision where a lot of individuals contribute who actually don't hold any valid information. They might make the result worse rather than better if they contribute. And an example is, for example, in elephants. Elephants are a very long-lived species. They live in socially, the females live socially with the offspring in matrilineal groups. And here the older females very often are much more experienced with respect to predation dangers, which predators are dangerous at which times, and also where to find watering holes in the dry season and things like that. And these elephants, although the decisions are often made by the oldest female or the oldest two or three females, because they hold better information than the others. Yeah? But what they still have got in common with the bees is they have one goal. And this is what Christian has just briefly mentioned now. What is the criterion for the outcome of the decision? Yeah? So the bees want the best hive, and the best hive is the best hive for all. The elephants have got also a common interest. They want to find safe places, they want to avoid predators for their young, and they want to find good watering places. They have got no conflict of interest between them as to what is the best outcome. They just have got different information how to achieve that best outcome. Yeah, but there is no conflict. But animals have also got, they're making also a lot of decisions where there is conflict. Especially in larger groups and in groups where the animals are not so closely related to each other, like large groups of ungulates, for example, in which a lot of relatively unrelated individuals can come together and forage together. And they have to make decisions together about where to forage and when to leave foraging patches. And they have an interest of staying together, so because they are safer and their safety in numbers. But they can also have conflicts because larger animals have got different requirements, for example, than smaller animals. Or females might have different requirements than males with respect to the best foraging sites or predators. For example, large males need much more food. On the other hand, they are not so threatened by predators. So they might want to go to an area to forage where there is a lot of food but which might be quite dangerous because there's a lot of predators around. But smaller animals, especially animals with small offspring, females, might prefer to go to areas where it is safer, where there are not so many predators, even if there's less food. So there are conflicts of interest within the group. And this will also affect how they should make collective decisions. Yeah, so you have got, if you make collective decisions, you have basically got two dimensions which can vary. One is how distributed is information between group members. And if information is very widely distributed, then a majority or pooling decision makes a lot of sense. And on the other hand, if you have got the decision is very concentrated on a few experts, then it doesn't make sense to make a majority decision. Then you really should ask the experts. So this is one dimension, how distributed is the information. The other dimension is how much conflicts of interest are there in the group. If there's no conflict, like in the bees, yeah? Or is there a lot of conflict, like in the ungulates, where they have different optimal foraging sites, yeah? And now, if you have got conflicts, it can make sense to make a majority decision for very different reasons, not in order to necessarily only to pool information, but in order to come to decisions where at least the majority doesn't suffer, or where you can get to compromise decisions, because there's a conflict. The majority is fairly happy with the decision outcome. So that could also lead to shared collective decision-making in order to diffuse conflict. Yeah? Now, of course, these two dimensions, conflicts, non-conflicts, and information dispersion, they can overlap. You can have decisions where you have got no conflict and dispersed information, like in the bees. And then it's a very obvious case for making a majority decision is a very, very good thing. Yeah? Then you have decisions where there's no conflict and concentrated experts which have the information. Information is concentrated on a few individuals, but there's no conflict. Here, you want the experts to make the decision, like in the elephants. Or you have got a decision where the information is relatively dispersed in ungulates. I mean, they do know approximately where the predators are. They do know approximately where the good foraging sites are. So all individuals hold information. But there is conflicts of interest. So again, they should, if they make the decision by majority, decisions are voting, they diffuse those conflicts. A problem or a dilemma arises when you have got concentrated information on one hand, but conflict on the other. Because concentrated information, concentrated on a few experts, means the expert should make the decision. But a conflict of interest means these experts might not have the same interest as every individual in the group. So for those individuals, or even maybe not even a majority of individuals might have a different interest. For them, it might not be a good idea if the experts make the decision. So here is a dilemma. Yeah, and I think an interesting, now I'm coming to humans. I think an interesting thing is, in animals, this kind of dilemma decisions are probably relatively rare. Yeah? Partly because groups in which have stayed a long time together are usually closely related. Where there is a difference in experience, they are usually closely related, so there is not usually relatively little conflict. That is evolutionary, if you're related to someone, their interests are your interests. In an evolutionary point of view. So in animals, these situations where information is concentrated on one hand, but conflicts exist is relatively rare. But this is the dilemma situation. This is a difficult situation. Now, I would say in humans, these decisions are much more common for two reasons. First of all, we are more complex. So we can make, as humans, very complicated decisions and very elaborate, complicated decisions which require a lot of knowledge, which profit from a lot of knowledge. And this knowledge might be quite concentrated on relatively few people. If you think about ecological decisions, I mean, how many of us really can understand these very, very complex decision-making which sometimes goes on? Now, this is very complex information. I mean, how many of us can hold that? So usually in humans, because we make such more complicated decisions than animals in general, I think that very often, expertise is far more often skewed, yeah, to fewer individuals. On the other hand, and this also distinguishes us from a lot of social animals, is we live very much in communities and groups or make decisions in large collectives or large groups which are not related to each other, like a nation. Yeah? So conflict, there's much, much more opportunity for conflict. So we often have this dilemma that we have got conflict situations to deal with, where majority decisions would be beneficial in order to diffuse the conflict. But on the other hand, the information sits with a few experts. And the majority decision, which is completely diffused, leads to the problem that a lot of misinformation can contribute to the decision, can lead to bad decisions. So now, how do we humans deal with these kind of dilemmas. And I think we have invented something very ingenious that's called representative democracy. So what we do is, rather than making a decision per se by a majority, we make a majority decision about which are our representatives, our experts, which of the group of potential experts do we think are representing our interests and our goals. Yeah? So we have solved this dilemma that in conflicts it's beneficial to have a majority decision. In skewed information, it's beneficial to make the experts make the decision. And we have solved this dilemma by saying, okay, rather than voting on the decision itself, including all the people who are not knowledgeable, we vote on our representatives. Yeah, so we have the benefit of both. Yeah? Okay.
Thanks very much, Larissa. Fascinating overview of the different forms collective intelligence can take and the distinctive problem we face as humans in these situations with localized information and a conflict of interest, and this fascinating idea that representative democracy comes out as being a particularly good way of making collective decisions in that sort of situation. I'm sure Brexit parallels are going to come up again. But I'd like again to invite our panelists to respond to those remarks from Larissa. Now let's start with Christine.
Yeah, I mean, a big challenge in the human case is institutional design for good decision making. And I think, as Larissa's remarks show, first of all, the complexity of the decision problem grows, and then also as the complexity of the society making the decision grows, we rapidly go beyond the kinds of cases that are illustrated among animal group decisions. And so we are faced with much more complicated institutional design tasks. I mean, the decision-making procedures among non-human animals engaged in collective decision-making are all ones that don't need to be sort of socially constructed by the relevant society of animals, but those are procedures that have evolved over a very long period of time in an evolutionary process, and they are in a sense hardwired in those animals' behavioral repertoire, as in the case of the bees. And we humans don't quite work like this, but we have to actively sit down and engineer our decision-making processes. And so then we actually face a genuine choice between whether we want to make decisions through direct voting on the issues, as in a referendum or indirect democracy, or whether instead we want to go for the representative democracy setup. We also have a choice over how much deliberation or communication there is prior to making a decision. Should we focus just on voting and expressing our antecedent views on the issue, or should we first talk and try to maybe converge on something approaching a consensus and then only vote after talking? And so for this reason, the institutional design question is particularly pressing for human societies. And we'll get to talk a bit more later about what lessons we can learn from insights on animal group decisions for the human problem of designing decision procedures.
Okay, I as a biologist might make now a bit of a provocative suggestion here, but I would say maybe, you know, these cultural, which I would call cultural aspects, yeah, of humans, are just a ripple on top of some fundamentals which most human societies share. And I think that majority decision making is actually to some degree hardwired in us. Yeah, I mean, we are very flexible. We can modify things. We can learn. We have got more ability to learn than any other species. Yeah, but I think some things like majority decisions, they sit so deeply in our concept of fairness. I mean, they're underlying. I think that most people would, you know, there is some kind of hardwired or some kind of pre, what do you call it, some
some pre-preparation for responding very well to majority decisions. I think we share that and we have that. And it comes usually on a much, much lower level than a democracy. I mean, a democracy is already a very, very big cultural construct on top of that. But if you're thinking now back about collective decisions to more to our ancestry, to, you know, then we think when most of our collective decisions in our early evolutionary history have been made in family groups and in extended family groups and in small, you know, in groups of up to 50 people and not more. Yeah? And in those groups, we have probably made an awful lot of decisions by majority vote, whereby it's always been that non-informed individuals, like children, for example, are very, very, they were usually excluded. We do exclude them still in our democracies. And that is very analog to the hive and, you know, to the swarm, the bee swarm, in which only the scouts vote and the uninformed individuals don't participate voluntarily. Yeah? But I would say that majority decision-making is something actually hardwired in us to some degree. Yeah, and that all these other things are then coming culturally on top of it. As our societies have grown from 50 people who were more or less related to each other to some huge, enormous, you know, 200 million or even more people who are not related and now have to make decisions collectively, I think this is when we needed more of those operational mechanisms. I suggest that. Okay.
The thing that kind of occurs to me is that a lot of the problem comes from the decision about who the experts are. So if we have a group of a lot of individuals with conflicting interests, and if we talk about there's a group of experts there, the problem there is often that the group of experts is subjectively defined, yeah, and a lot of people don't think that those are actually the experts. So the problem is defining who the experts actually are. And for animals, that's easy because most of the decisions that bees and elephants, etc., are making are ones that they've made millions of times over in their evolutionary history. So these are decisions where evolution, natural selection, has decided who the experts are, because in groups where those individuals, say the less experienced individuals, made the decisions, the genes didn't get passed on into the next generation. Whereas as humans, we're now in uncharted territory. We're not making decisions that have been made thousands of times over necessarily, especially when we make these big group decisions. So we don't have a kind of a rule about who the experts are going to be. And so we have to kind of make do. We haven't got evolution to shape our decision making in that respect. Mm-hmm.
I think this can be a problem that we don't know who actually the experts are. But what we usually often, what is often easier to know is who are not experts. So it's often easier to exclude people or individuals from decision making because you know they don't know anything. Yeah, even if you don't know who of the rest is actually knowledgeable, but you can already exclude the But then arises this additional problem with conflict. The moment you've got conflicts, you don't only want to identify who's knowledgeable, but you also want to identify who's knowledgeable and shares your interests. And I think that is far harder. It's far harder to say whether somebody is an expert, is now contradicting your innermost wishes because they know, they have your interests at heart, but know you're going the wrong direction, or whether they are trying to manipulate you. And this is another thing, I think, with humans, which probably Christian will mention about deliberation, opens and a huge door to manipulation, much, much larger than in animals. Yeah, I mean, animals do manipulate as well, don't get that wrong, but I think the sophistication of manipulation which animals can achieve is much lower than in humans. Yeah, so I think the identification of the expert who shares your interest, that is the hardest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, I'd now like to invite questions from the audience on this particular topic. Again, I'd ideally like to have a batch of three. Let's start here in the middle of the second row, and then we'll go back.
What I'd like to ask is there a threshold to a super hive that potentially humanity is approaching? And is there a set of profiles for that?
Great, thanks. And further questions? There's four rows from the back of the room. And then we'll come down to the front row.
Hi. The bees on the tree, they've already... What are they doing there? They've already cast themselves out of the hive in order to make the decision on where to go. Mm-hmm. So inside the hive, a decision's made on these people are leaving. They go out, they hop on the tree, and they've only got 3 days or something bad happens, I presume. Mm-hmm. They're in trouble. So they're forced to be quite decisive. To me, that seems a better parallel for the referendum, in a way, where they cast themselves into an unknown. They're not sure what's going to happen, and they just think it's important somehow, and it's an interesting first decision. I wonder what you think about that.
Great, and a final question from the front row here. Again, wait for the microphone to come to you, sorry if it takes a little while.
Thanks. Sorry about my voice. I'm reminded of the wagon trains heading west in the American settlement of the American West, and the wagon master making decisions, but also people and the relatively smaller groups versus how do you class what's going on? And I always bring this up. Donald Trump. This is a person with blatantly no expertise who's talking a load of nonsense, and yet so many people are following this and believe him. Where does this fall into this whole category of human decision making and what's best for the group? And
great, okay, thanks. So three great questions again. I mean, this issue of whether, what trajectory are humans on? You know, are we heading towards becoming a super hive, super organism, as some have suggested? This interesting thought about choosing a nest site as being a leap into the unknown. Even though, as you said, Ellie, this decision has a history, it's been done millions of times, each new one is nevertheless a kind of leap into the unknown. How do you reconcile those things? And then this lovely thought about, you know, how do we make sense of Trump as a kind of aberration of collective decision making? So let's put those questions to Larissa.
Okay, this is super high, first of all. I mean, from the point of view of collective decision making, and I think Christian is going to say more about this, if you have got a large number of people, if you have got this dispersed information and you want to get a good information, there comes actually, if you have got, whether you have got 100 or 1,000 people with dispersed information, there comes actually saturation point. Yeah, the more, the larger, at some point, the larger number of individuals does not really lead to much more of an increment in the quality of the decision outcome. Yeah. So if you have got dispersed information amongst 100 individuals and they make the decision collectively, that decision is only very, very slightly worse than if it is 100,000. Yeah, from a theoretical point of view. Yeah, so whether we are, so a super hive is not likely to be more intelligent than a hive from this point of view. Yeah, is that answering your question?
We can't really do follow-ups. There must be a transformation that potentially is happening, such as virtual social media, etc. That creates
something which is actually detrimental, or it can create something which is detrimental. That is, when you correlate people's opinions, when they don't really seek their own information and look at their own information anymore, but just start following in social media and start jumping, then you get some kind of cascades, information cascades, and they are actually bad for decision making. But I'm sure Christian is going to say more about this. Is that?
Say more about cascades.
Yeah, good. About cascades. So yeah, that is not necessarily an advantage for the decision making. So the next question was the jump into the unknown. Now, first of all, I mean, and there was also a question related to Brexit, a comparison to Brexit. Now, first of all, the jump into the unknown, the individuals don't have a choice. It's their best bet. So it's not as if the hive has become too small.
They can't all survive in it, yeah? And they can't do anything. They haven't got any alternative option, yeah? So it's not as if they decide, okay, we are fine here, but maybe we are better there. They know here they can't stay, so they have to make the jump, yeah? This is not the decision. This is not a decision they really can make. They have to make the jump. And then they have to make the best out of it. And the main reason why I think it is not comparable to Brexit is because of this conflict of interest business. The beast, as Ellie has already said, there is no conflict of interest. There is a best solution. And they all cooperate to find this best solution. Yeah, in Brexit, I think the main problem, or one of the main problems, was that you have got a huge amount of conflicting interests here. It was not that everybody who voted on this wanted to maximize the economical prospects for Britain. If that had been really the case, if everybody had tried to maximize the economical benefits for Britain, we would still be in the EU. There would not have been that decision. The problem is that there were huge masses of really, really conflicting interests. Yeah? And on the other hand, it was a very, very complex issue. The information was very, very skewed and concentrated in the hands of relatively few people who can really judge and even they have got difficulties with this, what the consequences for the economy might be, what the political consequences will be, the peace consequences, and things like that. So you have this dilemma situation actually here. And what I said previously, that humans have invented this really, really great solution to this dilemma of representative democracy. Of course, here although we are living in a representative democracy, they decided to make this decision with direct democracy. And I think this is possibly where I would see that they made a mistake. Yeah, that this is not a suitable way of making such a decision in the first place. Yeah, but I don't think it can be this really, really compared to the beast. And then Donald Trump, okay. That's a very difficult one, because here you... Is there any information at all? That is a very, very difficult one. I think, again, it is a conflict. It's probably a conflict of interest problem. There's probably a large proportion and the population who doesn't feel their interests are represented by any of the alternatives for some reason, rightly or wrongly. And I guess, yeah, it is. That is really. I think maybe I could give this to my colleagues. That question.
Well, I think it brings us on nicely in a way to the third key question. Mm-hmm. So perhaps we'll do that and bring Christian in on this. It makes me realise that this is really an ideal time to be having this event, in that we have some, shall we say, high profile collective decisions being made right now, raising this question of, well, what if anything can humans learn from the rest of the natural world, and perhaps from bees in particular, about how we might go about making collective decisions better. So to introduce that question, Christian.
Okay, so I'll maybe begin with just a quick remark about the Trump phenomenon before making the remarks that I was going to make. Of course, the Trump phenomenon is multifaceted, and giving a satisfactory explanation would be difficult and certainly beyond the scope of what we can do this evening here. But I think there's one relevant consideration that links to the topic tonight. The Trump phenomenon is at least in part a byproduct of an extremely great level of polarization in American society. I mean, that is an undeniable aspect of this phenomenon, although not the only one. And for several years already, American politics has been extremely polarized, and this polarization started well before the arrival of Trump. Now, here is one way in which polarization can come about. There is a widely discussed phenomenon in social psychology which is called the group polarization effect. So if you've got a large group of people who communicate to one another and then maybe change their opinions as a result of communication, then one of two things can happen. If this group is fairly heterogeneous, then the communication and exchange of information can actually have a moderating effect in that their views might shift more in the direction of some compromise position in the middle. I mean, for instance, if you think of politically left versus politically right. So communicating in a heterogeneous group has a moderating effect. But communicating in a group which is a bit more homogeneous and even just, you know, slightly ideologically tilted in one direction rather than another, maybe slightly tilted to the right or slightly tilted to the left, has the tendency to reinforce the previous very slight tilt or bias and move it into a slightly more extreme direction. Now, what we find in a very large country like the United States is that different people, different voters, different citizens live in different informational environments. So they basically self-select into talking with different groups of people. They also listen to different TV and radio stations, and they use different internet sites. They acquire their news from different sources. They have different Facebook friends. And so they rely on very, very different informational channels. And in this kind of situation, one can very easily get a scenario where like-minded people are more likely to communicate with each other than they are to communicate with people of a different political orientation. And in such a scenario, then you can easily get this group polarization effect, whereby those tilting in the rightward direction get their views amplified, those tilting towards the left get their views also amplified, and then step by step that can give rise potentially to a more politically polarized society. And so, and this is just one small aspect of what is a much more complex phenomenon, but certainly group polarization seems to play a role here in explaining the rise of Trump. But now just some remarks about hive minds in humans. There is a classic example of a human hive mind that goes back to the statistician and scientist Francis Galton. In 1906, he attended a country fair somewhere in the countryside, and there was a competition there. A fat ox was on display. And the people at this country fair were asked to submit guesses of what the weight of the ox is. So different people just looked at the fat ox, and you know, each one could submit their own guess. You know, is it 1,000 pounds or 800 pounds or 600 or 1,500 or whatever it might be. And I think several hundred people submitted their individual guesses. And of course, individually, you know, some might be better at guessing the weight of an ox than others. So individually, their guesses were all over the place. But Galton noticed that when you look at the average guess of these several hundred contestants, it turned out that the average guess was just incredibly close to the true weight. So the true weight was something just under 1,200 pounds, if I remember correctly. And I think the average guess was just a little bit under. Maybe the average guess was 1,140 and the true weight was 1,190 or something like that. It's a very, very striking illustration of a hive mind phenomenon, where each individual perhaps is sort of a little bit reliable at making these guesses, but still makes guesses that are quite fallible and where there is a lot of error in individual guesses. But given the independence of those guesses across different individuals, pooling them by averaging, in this case, takes us very close to the truth. There is a theoretical explanation for this kind of phenomenon that is even older. It goes back to Nicolas de Condorcet, a great scholar and polymath in 18th century France. So Condorcet thought about how juries in a criminal trial make decisions. So in a criminal trial, you've got a question to answer, namely, is this particular defendant guilty or not? Or make it even more factual, has this particular defendant committed this crime or not? Is Smith the murderer or not? That sort of question. You've got a bunch of different jurors. Now, each juror makes their best judgment in light of the information that they've received. Condorcet said, let's make two simple assumptions about this. I mean, they are a bit idealistic, but nonetheless, they are a useful starting point. Let's assume that the jurors are each better than random at making a correct judgment about whether the defendant is guilty or innocent. So each juror is not just like a coin toss, because a coin toss would not give us any reliable insight, but it's a little bit better. So maybe each juror has a chance of, I don't know, 55% of getting it right, against only 45% of getting it wrong. That's sort of a little bit better than random, but not super great. Let's further assume that different jurors are mutually independent from one another. So that's perhaps more of an idealization, because in the real world they talk to each other, but let's just make these assumptions. Then Condorcet observed a striking statistical fact, namely, if you take a majority vote among the jurors, each of whom is a little bit better than random at making a correct judgment, and where the different jurors are mutually independent, then the majority judgment is more likely to be correct than the judgment of each individual juror. That is actually just a byproduct of the law of large numbers. Aggregating many such judgments tends to extract the signal, the information from the judgments, while filtering out some of the noise. And even more strikingly, as the jury size grows, and if you still keep these idealized assumptions in place, the reliability of the majority judgment would increase further and further and further. And if you had a very large jury, maybe with 1,000 jurors, then the reliability would be very close to perfect. That's the sort of theory. Now, in reality, humans face many problems with collective decisions, some of which we've already discussed, and the problem of informational cascades came up. So it's very, very difficult in the human case to ensure that we really pool independent information. Rather, you know, we always, of course, influence each other, but often for perfectly good reasons. But sometimes this influencing can adversely affect the reliability of a collective decision. Here's a simple example. Suppose you walk along a street with a lot of restaurants, and you know nothing about the quality of these restaurants. From the outside, they all look more or less the same. Maybe the price is also more or less the same. Now, suppose that a lot of these restaurants are just empty, and then there's this one restaurant which is packed, and there's just this one last table available. Then you probably think, oh, well, if there are so many people in this restaurant, it must be good. So these people can't all have got it wrong, and then you rush there and ask for the last remaining table. And in this way, it seems like the people have voted with their feet that this is the preferred restaurant or somehow the best restaurant in the street. But now imagine that what really happened was this. Initially, the street, all the restaurants were completely empty, and then these random people just walked along, they saw 10 empty restaurants, and they had to wander into one. Then the next set of people came along, and they saw, oh well, these are completely empty, but here there is at least one set of diners, so they jumped in as well. The third person came along and saw, well, two diners, so they must know something, and they also walked in, and I mean, so you see how the story continues. This is basically a simple illustration of an informational cascade. The amazing thing about the bees' decision process is that they actually manage to block these informational cascades, and that's, I think, where we get back to the fact-checking issue. If the bees had designed, or evolution, let's suppose, had accidentally arrived at a different kind of mechanism, which it wouldn't, because that would not have been very beneficial for the bees, but suppose it had arrived at a different mechanism, one where the bees, the scout bees, discover nest sites, then they start dancing for them. Maybe the first scout bee really thinks this is a good nest site, starts dancing. But then, suppose the other scout bees observing the dance don't go and check out the nest site quality, which is the which is the fact-checking part, but they don't do the fact-checking, and they just join in the dance blindly, much like our hypothetical diners, you know, join that group in the restaurant without doing any further fact-checking of how good the restaurant is. Then you get a very rapid snowball effect of convergence of dance activities supporting one particular site without any fact-checking, or maybe just a little bit of fact-checking by the very first scout bee. You'd get a consensus very quickly, to be sure, but you totally lose this nice feature, namely the reliability of the process. And what is so amazing about this process, and that's, I think, where a useful lesson for humans comes in, is that the bees combine two key features that we also see in many human decision processes, but that need to be balanced in the right way. So on the one hand, there is the interdependence among the bees, a bit like the deliberation among humans, namely the bees signal to one another which nest sites deserve checking out. But then there's also an independence aspect of the whole thing, namely the new scout bees don't just blindly trust this verdict, but they go there and they check the quality of that nest site. And this finely balanced mechanism involving both interdependence at this sort of communication stage, signaling to each other which nest sites are worth checking out, but then independent fact-checking is what allows the bees to make reliable decisions, but also to make relatively speedy decisions. And I think much in the same way in which human engineers in, let's say, aircraft design learn lessons from biology, I mean, I think we've all come across the idea of sort of biomorphic engineering. We look at designs that nature has evolved and then learn from this and how to design the aerodynamically optimal aircraft wing or other such things. So I think there is also a case to be made for biomorphic lessons in institutional design. And so even though human decisions are very, very different from those decisions made by the bees, one key lesson we can learn, and that's sort of the answer then to Jonathan's question, is that we should think very much about how we can combine the interdependence aspect of deliberation and communication, which is a key ingredient of our human democracies, with this independence aspect of the fact-checking and pooling of genuinely independent and verified information. And that's, I think, where some crucial lessons can be learned.
Thanks very much, Christian. So, Ellie, further thoughts on lessons from the hive for human decision-making?
The thing that seems really important is the fact-checking. And I was thinking about the different situations in which this kind of system has evolved in animals, and it seems to me that every time it does evolve, it incorporates some kind of fact-checking mechanism. So, for example, ants have to make exactly the same decision as the bees, and the way that they make it has evolved entirely independently, because the common ancestor of bees and ants was a solitary insect. It had no society, so it didn't have to make any collective decisions about where to nest. But the system that the ants have evolved is almost identical. They have different recruitment mechanisms, but they also have this fact-checking system where every individual goes to the site and makes a judgment for itself and then starts to recruit other individuals to the site. With the ants, they do it via pheromone trails rather than waggle dances. But just the fact that the fact-checking has evolved more than once independently seems to say that this is a really important aspect of the system. In other cases where there's perhaps less opportunity for fact-checking, so other animals making decisions about that involve using social information, there's a lot of evidence that, in fact, because of these informational cascades, social information is often ignored unless you actually really need it. So, for example, fish won't copy each other in terms of food sites unless there's a high risk to themselves of trying to learn for themselves, so unless there's a lot of predators around, that kind of thing. So it seems like if you can't check your facts, then typically you don't rely on, or evolution leads you not to rely on social information quite as much as if you can check the facts. So I think it really kind of underlines how important it is.
Vanessa?
Okay. Earlier on, the super hives were mentioned and the social media. Now, with this interdependence and independence, you have already mentioned the problem about social media, about polarization of groups. But independent of this, with this idea of the super hive, do you think the possibility that we can communicate with everybody and anybody is shifting the interdependence and independence of how we form our opinions in either, or does it shift it in a positive or in a negative way? What do you?
Yeah, if we take into account the points about group polarization, then I think there is really a worry that the way in which communication channels now work does really favor polarization. If we go back to a sort of imaginary scenario, well, I mean, maybe it was never that ideal in the past, but you know, well before the internet and social media and so on, where there's just one television channel, which is a public sphere in some ways. Of course, having just one television channel can be also perhaps abused by those in power who can potentially maybe control the flow of information. I mean, that is very much a possibility, but on the other hand, if we have a well-functioning public sphere that is shared, then we wouldn't run into these polarization problems quite as much as we do now. Or even if there is a sort of smallish number of information sources, but there is enough exchange of information between them, then maybe it's also not so bad. But I mean, now we basically have a situation where everyone through social media can completely customize the information flow that arrives on their computer screens or in their inboxes. I mean, they can even select the news feeds such that, in a sense, only news items that would already perhaps confirm their pre-existing worldview will arrive in their inbox. I mean, and it's not even that we do this for any kind of sinister reason or because we deliberately want to be biased. It's just a byproduct of the fact that maybe we are more likely to be connected with some people rather than others via Facebook, and they are more likely perhaps to like certain things than others or to alert us to certain things than others. And then very quickly you can have this situation that I described earlier of homogeneous rather than heterogeneous groups talking to each other and thereby reinforcing their prior political opinions and potentially making them more extreme.
Okay, I'd just like to invite a final batch of questions from the audience on this topic of lessons from the hive for human decision making. Let's start at the very front here and then we'll go further back.
My question would be on trust. I mean, is there not a breakdown in trust when we humans to check the facts? I mean, and because we don't have access directly to any facts, so we rely on people we trust for that. Whereas in the hive, I mean, do you imagine a breakdown in trust among the scouts and the rest of the hive?
And a question from the very end of the third row from the back there. Yes.
Hi. I have a question. Maybe I just don't understand it too well, but when you mentioned that each bee can only scout for one side, and then the bees coming back scouting for other sides, when they see a bee performing a dance for another side, they signal it to stop dancing. So to me, this is this bee has to believe other bees that she has to stop dancing without checking those other sides, right? So this is so how does it work? Is it just when she reaches enough signals, it stops dancing?
Okay, great, thanks. And let's have a final question from directly in front there.
You're blaming social media, but isn't there a sort of inbuilt bias in humans? I mean, humans are not, they get more reward by reading the news that they like than reading news they don't like. So, I mean, the bees, maybe they're not as smart, but they make smarter decisions because they're not smart. We are, in a way, maybe we got more intellectual power, but the reward, in inner reward, is towards confirmation, the confirmation bias. So we get more reward by reading what we like. So isn't there a sort of a problem, sort of an institutionalized problem of the human race?
Okay, great. Thanks very much for three really interesting questions. I mean, two really on this theme of trust, right, and whether the role of trust in human decision-making marks a significant difference, or whether there is an element of trust in the bees too, because there comes a point where the bees have to trust the judgments of other bees. And then a third question here about whether it's part of human nature that there's this inevitable problem with social media leading us to create these echo chambers of our views reinforcing themselves. So let's go to Christian, particularly on that third question.
Yeah, so I'd like to comment on that third question. I mean, the first thing I want to clarify is that, of course, I don't want to generally blame social media, because social media also create a huge opportunity, and clearly, I mean, there are many great things to be said about much easier access to information that we get through the internet and these facilities. This can also have a great empowering and democratizing effect. So that I think I should point out. Nonetheless, I think reinforcing polarization is one potential byproduct of the current configuration of communication via social media, among other channels. I do agree with you that confirmatory bias as a psychological phenomenon, very well established one, might reinforce this. I mean, confirmatory bias is just this well-documented psychological tendency that we have, which is to respond more strongly, in a sense, to evidence that confirms views that we already hold or accept than to respond to evidence that is disconfirming. So we kind of selectively focus on confirming rather than disconfirming evidence, and that might actually further amplify the point that I made. But I think an interesting feature of this group polarization effect is that while it might get reinforced by the confirmatory bias psychology, this effect would actually happen even if there was no such thing as confirmatory bias, even if our response to the evidence presented to us was entirely rational in some sort of completely idealized way. We could still have a situation in which a slightly too homogeneous or either, you know, right-leaning or left-leaning informational environment where we are not faced with signals coming from a very different, let's say, political opinion. That sort of environment would reinforce biases and amplification even in perfectly rational individuals, just because of the tilt in the informational environment itself. But I think you're absolutely right that confirmatory bias probably strengthens or reinforces this effect.
Eddie, perhaps you could come in on this question of whether there comes a point in the process at which bees do trust other bees.
Mm-hmm. So there's two things that the bees might have to trust each other with, right? So one is that whether they share the same priorities, whether they're looking for the same thing, and for that there's no question, because they all need to get that queen to a new nest site. But the other thing they have to trust is whether each other have made a good decision and assessed the nest site properly, and that's maybe where your question at the back came in that so they have this system with the dancing where one individual getting it wrong can't create a cascade. But you're absolutely right that perhaps with the stop signal they could, because they have to rely on this other bee telling them stop dancing, I've found a better site, and that's the bit where they don't rely on that signal, so they won't respond to just one stop signal. They have to get a lot of different stop signals from a lot of different bees to actually stop dancing, so they have a kind of fail-safe mechanism there where one individual who's got it wrong can't cause a problem there. So they don't trust each other in that way.
Yeah, about the trust. I mean, I again want to emphasize the conflicts and the role of conflicts here. I mean, in the bees, you only have to trust the judgment of the bee, not her intention, not her motives, not her interest, but in conflict situations. Yeah, somebody might inform you or give you an information because they genuinely hold this information, yeah, or because they want to manipulate you. And it is, and it is difficult to tell for sure which of the two. So the moment there are conflicts, yeah, trust does become a problem. The moment there are conflicts and the information is skewed. I mean, if you hold information, if the information is equally distributed and you hold information yourself, you can just listen to an awful lot of people and then you can make up your mind. But if the information is skewed and you have to rely on the information of an expert and you yourself can't fact check, you know, like the bees can, then whether you trust or don't trust depends on whether this is a conflict situation or non-conflict situation. And to illustrate this, I give you a non-conflict situation where you usually do trust the expert, and this is when you go to your doctor. Because you know your doctor has got, or you hope your doctor has got the same interest, yeah? And there you usually do trust. But when it comes to politics, because you know the experts have got their own agendas, this is when trust can become difficult.
Great. I mean, let's just wrap up by trying to settle this question of, are human collectives smarter or stupider than hives of bees? I mean, I'll put my cards on the table and say, I think stupider. You know, I think, sure, on an individual level, an individual human is smarter than an individual bee, but the manifestation at the group level of conflict of interest at the individual level is collective stupidity. Do you agree? Any stupider or smarter?
I don't think that the humans are stupider. I think they're facing much more difficult decisions because evolution hasn't given them a solution, whereas the decisions that the animals are making are ones that have been done thousands of times.
I agree with Ellie. I don't think they are stupider. I think the decisions are partly because they haven't got evolution to fall back on, but partly because we have got far more complex societies. And this is not a question of numbers, this is a question of different interests. I mean, a beehive, however big it is, ultimately has got one common interest. And that's just not true for humans. And therefore, it makes it much, much, much harder to make good collective decisions.
Yeah, I agree with that. And also, of course, it depends on the collective and the setting in question. But I think it's important to also notice that there are some great success stories of human collective intelligence. And I think one of the biggest success stories is science in its entirety. I mean, science is a massive system of collective information pooling, collective wisdom. If you like, the scientific community is a kind of hive mind. And obviously, science as a collective enterprise has made amazing breakthroughs over the centuries or even over the millennia, accumulating the contributions of many different individuals, none of whom could individually have achieved anything even close to what the scientific community as a whole has achieved. And also, it's a self-correcting system. I mean, once in a while, or quite often, mistakes are made, and sometimes incorrect scientific beliefs or theories or hypotheses become entrenched for a little while. But eventually, there is a self-correction mechanism in that everything is subjected to rigorous critical testing. And step by step, really, science advances to more accurate representation of the phenomena it seeks to represent. So I would actually suggest that, especially science, is one of the greatest success stories of human collective intelligence, not just intragenerationally, but even intergenerationally.
Okay, thanks everyone for coming, and thanks very much for your questions. All that remains is to thank our panelists for their attention.